Romans chapter 9, and we have been working through this passage as a part of dealing with common objections, as well as, I think, presenting a positive case for Reformed faith. And, of course, we have been looking at various phrases in the Scriptures here in Romans chapter 9 that have been given some of the most incredibly unusual interpretations over the course of human history, since they were penned by the Apostle Paul about 2,000 years ago. The official keeper of the record, where exactly were we? The problem is I preached on this very passage twice between now and then, and hence I know I've explained it. I just don't remember exactly in what context I did. Verse 16 next time. All right, there you go. Well, I had actually done some work on 20 this morning, but we can move back from there. I actually preached on this at the Founders Conference in Lynchburg and dealt with it some in Nashville as well. So it's a passage a lot of folks have a lot of questions about. So we were taking a look at it. And for those of you who are wondering, no, this is not a large print Bible. I can actually read it from standing this far away, but only with my right eye. I don't know what the final result's going to be, but I still have contacts in both eyes, which are now nice and dirty and dry and extremely miserable. But once those things get out, then a couple weeks from now we'll have an idea. I already scored 20-20 on the right, but the left one, they had to go and like hold up, make people stand in the form of letters before I could figure out which letters they were with the left one. It's just really super, super fuzzy because it has the same complications I had last time, called epithelial fluff, where basically I have, I won't tell you what the doctor said I have as far as epithelium goes, but he's from New York, so he's a little rough. But make long story short, you touch my epithelium and it falls apart. So it's still healing up in the left eye, and once it's healed up, then we'll have an idea what's going on. But I can see it with the right one, and so verse 16, of course, we looked last time at Exodus chapter 33, and I know. Just half a degree. Gets a little warm up on this side, don't get a lot of circulation. Last time we looked at Exodus chapter 33, from which verse 15 comes. And at least I think we looked at Exodus chapter 33. At some point over the past 3 weeks, I have looked at Exodus 33 in preaching on Romans chapter 9. Let's put it that way. Whether it was here or not is beyond my frazzled brain to recall. And we looked at the freedom of God in giving mercy to whom he has mercy and having compassion on whom he would have compassion. And then we have the inspired interpretation, or at least application of these words, in verse 16, so then it does not depend on the man who wills or the man who runs, but on God who has mercy. And I had mentioned at that particular point in time that when we look at verse 16, literally what we have, therefore it is not of the willing one, and that is the standard Greek term, thello, in a participial form that is used for the will of man. If we were going to use any term to describe the classical concept of free will, the will would probably be the thelema, or here in the verbal form, to thello, to will. And here you have a direct negation of the idea that the final deciding factor is on the part of the willing one, the one who is engaging in an act of will. It is very clear, it is very strident in its assertion, and that is why, of course, there are all sorts of interesting interpretations that attempt to remove Romans chapter 9 from having anything to do with the doctrine of salvation itself. So it does not depend on the willing one. There actually is no word man in the text. It is literally not of the one willing. Man is assumed, if that's in your translation. Neither of the running one, and this again would somewhat be metaphorical in the sense of the one striving, the one trying to do something, the one who is active, the man who wills, the man who runs, the man who makes a choice, the man who desires, or the man who engages in activity to attempt to obtain something. In either case, you have basically all of human activity here. You have the internal will and you have the external activity. And Paul is saying this is not the origin and source of salvation. This is not the deciding factor in salvation. Instead, the contrast that is drawn is it is not of this. Instead, in opposition to that, 180 degrees opposite of that, it is of the mercying God. The mercying God. And again, mercy is a verb in Greek. We don't have a verb for mercying. We have to have mercy. Mercy is only a noun in our language. I guess you could then it can be used descriptively, be merciful, but we don't have a verb to mercy. Well, there is in Greek. And instead of saying it comes from the one willing or the one running, the opposite of that is it comes from the mercying God. And I don't know how much plainer it can get. I think that when you start looking at passages like this, it really comes down to an issue of the willingness of the heart to listen, the willingness of a person to bow to God. I can't help but think of the words of the BYU professor that I debated a few weeks ago, who in describing his time as a Presbyterian and upon reading the Westminster Confession of Faith, where it talks about these very issues, said that even when he was a Presbyterian, he could not help but find such beliefs monstrous. That was his very description. And the man who is still willing and the man who is still running and who hasn't realized that it is all dependent upon the God who has mercy will find these truths to be monstrous. And even last Sunday morning, I stood in a church after preaching on John chapter 6 and spoke with a lady who repeated the same line I have heard over and over and over again upon having it clearly asserted. What is the basis of salvation? Well, Paul says in Ephesians chapter 1, the basis of salvation is found in the will of God. Upon what basis does God choose? There's got to be something in us. No, it's not anything in us at all. It is, in fact, according to the good pleasure of His will, the praise of His glorious grace. And even with the text having been read, this individual just shook her head and said, I simply cannot believe in a God like that. I simply cannot believe in a God like that. And that is very often the case, that these types of words really do reveal the willingness of an individual to bow to these passages. Then, upon making this interpretation of Exodus 33, which again comes from the history of Israel, this is nothing new. Paul wasn't making this stuff up. This is part and parcel of how God had always behaved and had shown himself to his people. Verse 17, for the scripture says to Pharaoh, for this very purpose I raised you up, to demonstrate my power in you and that my name might be proclaimed throughout the whole earth. And so here you have a citation. This is from Exodus 9:16, where the apostle again draws from an illustration, this time the illustration being personally directed to Pharaoh. This is directed to an individual. And yes, you know, people try to argue, well, Pharaoh now represents the Egyptian nation. Well, obviously, it is stretching credulity just a little bit to say that what God did was he raised up the Egyptian nation thousands of years in the past just to show his name and his power in them in the Exodus itself. Obviously, the much more rational reading of the text is that he's talking specifically to Pharaoh, that he raised up this particular Pharaoh and put him in the position he was in so that he might demonstrate his name and his power and that his name might be proclaimed through the whole earth through the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, the fact that Pharaoh himself would have, even in a human sense, after a certain number of these plagues, Pharaoh could have very much, just simply for the preservation of his own skin, given in and let the people go. But God had a specific purpose in what he was doing with Moses in the Exodus. Many people have pointed out that the various plagues, the 10 plagues upon Egypt, struck at the very gods of Egypt itself. So that there was a demonstration of the superiority of God to every one of the major Egyptian deities. And that demonstration would not have been complete had Pharaoh just, in essence, saved his own skin and relented and let the people go, not because he wanted to do what was right. That certainly was not a part of Pharaoh's desire, but just simply out of selfish self-preservation. But this is not what God has to happen. This is not a part of his sovereign plan. As soon as Pharaoh received release, then God would harden his heart, or he would harden his own, which of course would be a natural thing for a sinful man to do. But God is active in bringing about the desired result. He's raised Pharaoh for this purpose. And the real issue at that point that people have a problem with, of course, is that we, in Western culture, resist the idea that God's purposes are superior to man's purposes. That my purpose for my life, my choices for my life are superior to anyone else's. Well, that's the most important thing in the world, is my purpose for my life, in essence. And therefore, if God says I have a purpose beyond that, we say, well, you know, that's just not fair. You need to bow to my desires, my wills, my wishes, and we'll see how that comes out here just in a moment. But Paul's interpretation of what happens with Pharaoh really strikes at the heart of everything. So then he has mercy on whom he desires, and he hardens whom he desires. Literally, again, the text utilizes verbs that we don't have. He is mercying whom he desires, and he is hardening whom he desires. And that is, in fact, those of you who have, are familiar with medical terminology might be familiar with arterial sclerosis or multiple sclerosis. Sclerao means to harden, and that is the verb that is used here, from which we get the concept of hardening, and all through the medical field you'll have that use of that very very same Greek term. Obviously, the first part of verse 18 doesn't bother too many people. So then he has mercy on whom he desires. Of course, there are many who would say no. He has mercy if he is going to have mercy at all. If God is going to be merciful, then he must be equally merciful to every single individual, or he is not truly merciful. This is the same argument used for the love of God. If God is going to be loving, then he must be equally loving to every single individual, or he is not loving at all. In other words, the argument that is presented is if we're going to say God is all anything, then he must be only that thing. There can be no discretion, there can be no freedom, there can be no exercise of will or no exercise of purpose in a demonstration of any of God's attributes. Is an argument that is very popular today. It is an argument that says, look, we say that God is omnibenevolent, that he is all-loving. And therefore what that means, and there are those who take it to this point, is that God loves every single creature, include not just human beings, but every single creature, equally, fully, does everything within his capacity and power to redeem every single creature, which would include fallen angels. And one of the great mysteries is that in eternity to come, those that do not enter into the fullness of his life, that God will suffer along with them in his unfulfilled desires. And you go, there are people who believe that? Yes, there are. And in fact, that kind of thinking leads very logically to neo-Orthodox views of universalism that say that because God desires the salvation of all people, that eventually all people will be saved, and that the only reason we proclaim the gospel today You see, once people die and they get to heaven, they go, oh, oh I should have known. All is wonderful. All is forgiven. And the only bad thing and the only reason we proclaim the gospel now is that people are missing out on the fullness that they can be now in this life. When they die, it's not going to matter in eternity. The suffering that will be theirs is only a metaphor for their sorrow at what they could have enjoyed during this life, which I sort of consider, let's say they live to be 70 years old, you're going to live for eternity. 70 years, eternity, yeah, well, you know, missed out. Well, but I got eternity to go, so it's not really any big deal. But this becomes a very common belief. There are many today standing in churches that were built 150, 200 years ago by believing Christians, for example, in Presbyterian denominations. The PCUSA is filled with ministers today who would embrace this concept of a neo-Orthodox universalism where everyone is going to be saved, and that really our whole purpose in this life and in the spreading the gospel is to convince people to experience life to its fullness now, even though when you die it's not going to make any difference anyways, because all will be well. And that's where a lot of this type of stuff comes from. This freedom of God, you know, this idea that, well, you know, he has mercy on whom he desires, and what that really means is he has mercy on everybody, and the mercy is equal, either results in, if you believe that mercy will actually accomplish something, you either have to embrace universalism, everybody's going to be saved, or you have to recognize, well, if the mercy actually accomplishes anything and not everyone's going to be saved, then you need to be reformed. But those people in the middle go, well, he has mercy on who he desires. That is, he has equal mercy on everybody, but it's really up to the man and mankind as to whether that mercy accomplishes anything, and that's Arminianism. Those are your various takes on these concepts. And just briefly, in passing, it's amazing to me that people will stand before audiences and argue that God cannot have the very freedom that you and I have. And yet they do it. They do it all the time. This idea that if God is truly to be merciful, then he must have equal mercy. If God is truly to be loving, he must have equal loving. We don't believe that for human beings. We do not operate on that basis in regards to human beings. We recognize that in our experience, there are particular people within our lives who are closer to us and who experience a different kind of love from us than others. And that if we couldn't make that distinction, we would be less than human. If you can't tell the difference you're supposed to have in love for your wife or your husband in comparison to somebody else's wife or husband, that can get you into a lot of trouble. We're supposed to be able to tell the difference. And in fact, we're supposed to be able to exercise a discrimination at that point. And if we ran around treating Osama bin Laden the same way we do our kids, and providing for him and all the rest of this stuff, this world would be a mess. Obviously, there has to be a freedom on our part to be able to be discriminating in recognizing relationships and the value of relationships and purposes of relationships and everything else. But when it comes to God, no, God doesn't have that freedom. God is lesser than us in that he has no capacity to have any kind of differentiation in his love or his mercy. There can be no redemptive love over against the concept of common grace. There can be nothing, none of that stuff. It's just all got to be what I call the peanut butter concept, is you dig that knife down the peanut butter and you just slap it across the bread and you just give it a nice even coat, and that's just the way it's supposed to be. And that is a very, very, very common perspective. It doesn't fly very well in the light of a passage like this, because the passage makes a specific assertion, so then he mercies whom he desires and he hardens whom he desires. And when you think about what the text is saying, the differentiation is based upon God's willing, God's desiring. It is God who determines which of these two groups is going to receive mercy and which is going to receive hardening, and it's based upon his will, and we know that that's based upon the purpose that he is working out. Same thing with Pharaoh and the fact that he was working out his purpose, that he had an overriding purpose, the demonstration of his power, and that his name might proclaim throughout the whole earth. And Paul understands that to mean God is free in the giving of mercy, and then, of course, the end of verse 18, he hardens whom he desires. Automatically is misinterpreted 99.9% of the time. Whenever you read something like this, there's this automatic rejection that says, well, so what you're saying then is that God makes men worse than they are. And that's not what it says. This came up in the conversation that I was mentioning from just last Sunday morning after the service. And I asked this particular individual, I said, well, let me ask you, would God have been just to have struck Pharaoh down the first time Pharaoh committed a high-handed sin against him? Well, yeah. Oh, so if God could have simply, you know, called fire down out of heaven to consume his adversaries, God is just. He can do that, right? Well, yeah. So do you think Pharaoh had sinned prior to Moses showing up? Well, of course he had sinned prior to Moses showing up. All right. If Pharaoh had sinned prior to Moses' encounter with him, then Pharaoh's living on what at this point in time? If God could have justly already struck him down, then what's Pharaoh living on? Grace and mercy. So God has been gracious and merciful to Pharaoh already in that he has extended to him life beyond, life at all when you think about it, since when you consider original sin and things like that. But certainly by this time in his life, Pharaoh has committed any number of egregious, high-handed acts of rebellion against God, and yet God has maintained him. Do you think God does things for a purpose? Well, of course he does things for a purpose. So here you have Pharaoh, and don't you think that God has, in fact, at point in times, restrained Pharaoh's sinfulness, kept Pharaoh from going farther? Don't you think that maybe there were times when Moses appeared before Pharaoh? We know, reading the text, that he was very angry with Moses. He said, "Don't you ever appear before me again," and all the rest of this stuff. Don't you think there were times that God restrained Pharaoh from just having his guards fall upon Moses and kill him? Well, of course he had. We just don't, you know, when God restrains evil, we don't see it as clearly as when he doesn't restrain evil. And so God has this man's living on grace. God would be just to destroy him at any point, but God chooses to use him to bring about good, honor and glory for God. And see, that's the real thing, is that we don't consider God's honor and glory to be a good. That's one of the main problems. Man automatically thinks that personal rights of the pot are more important than the honor and glory of the potter. That's really when you start digging down to the bottom where the real problem here is. Because even though we know Pharaoh is justly condemned, and we know that Pharaoh is created by God, there's still this disconnect because we can see a little bit of ourselves in Pharaoh. And we don't like the idea that God has the freedom to do with his pots as he pleases. But anyways, so I asked all these questions. So when it says that he hardened Pharaoh's heart, that's worse than just simply taking him out of existence? He didn't have the right to do that, to bring about good, even in this man's own sin? Why doesn't he have the right to that? You're telling me that God can't even bring good out of man's sin? You're saying that if we're sinners, you know, that automatically precludes God from bringing glory to himself through the means by which he destroys a particular sinner, which he did in Pharaoh's case? By bringing honor and glory to himself, bringing deliverance to the people of Israel, giving them the Passover and the signs that point to Christ that are so beautiful to us today, and looking at the Passover sacrifice and the blood of the Lamb and all the rest of the stuff. And all that's not as important as one pagan dude who could have been wiped out the first time he sinned but wasn't anyways. talk about the idolatry of the pot, thinking the pot's really important. It's incredible. And so he hardens whom he desires, and we automatically focus upon that. I've said many, many times, the amazing statement in Romans 9:18 is not that he hardens whom he desires, but he has mercy on anyone. That's the amazing part of Romans 9:18, but we miss that. We don't take the time to look at that. Well, verses 19 and 20, I'll just get started on these. Tremendous passage. You will say to me then, why does he still find fault? For who resists his will? On the contrary, who are you, O man, who answers back to God? The thing molded will not say to the molder, why did you make me like this, will it? And it very, very frequently I have the opportunity of pointing out to folks that their responses to the presentation of God's freedom and man's inabilities parallels directly the objections raised here in Romans chapter 9, both here and above. We looked at the other objection earlier about God, injustice with God. And it's amazing how many times I've pointed out to someone, did you know that you are voicing the very same objection as the apostle himself responds to? In other words, you're voicing his opponent's objection. You are joining with the opponents of the apostle. And there have been times that it's just like, well, so? And it's like, well, that means you're opposing Paul here. Well, I just can't see how anyone could believe that God acts this way. I mean, John 3:16 says, you know, and that's basically the kind of conversation that takes place. But obviously, I think for anyone who's seriously considering wanting to be truly biblical in their teaching and in their belief, if you end up saying, why does he still find fault or who resists his will? First of all, what is that objection? I think we need to listen carefully to what the objection is. I think our interpretation of this entire passage will be greatly enriched if we really think about what is being said at this point. It's not just an objection. We've already had the objection. Someone's saying, there's no injustice with God, is there? May it never be. Verse 14. Now we have the specific words, in quotes even, in the numeric sarin anyways, why does he still find fault? For who resists his will? And so there's more to this objection than just meets the eye. We understand where it's coming from in regards to what is being said. That is, why does God still condemn? Why does he still find fault? And what is condemnation and finding fault? Those are functions of judging. And so, in essence, there is in this objection an attack upon the righteousness of God to judge if, in point of fact, he has full freedom and is sovereign over all things. And that's, again, a very common objection. Many, many people will say, well, there can't be any meaningful grounds for God to judge someone if, in point of fact, God is sovereign over all things, he works all things after the counsel of his will, then how in the world can God actually condemn anybody? Because we're just doing what we're just chatty Cathy dolls. We've been, someone's pulled our string, and we're going, according to the way we've been designed, or so on and so forth. This is just simply destroys all possibility of human responsibility. And that's, in essence, what this objection is saying. God cannot judge, God cannot find fault, if in point of fact, what is at the base of all things is his will. And at least this objector understands that God's will, if God's will is at the base of all things, is irresistible. At least this objector doesn't go quite as far as many people today do in thinking that, well, God's will, man's will, six of one, half dozen the other, they're sort of equal things. The objector recognizes that doesn't work at all and cannot function in that way at all. So, excuse me, where's the cough button? Hey, I got to it. In fact, toward the end, I was hitting it all the time. Wasn't that fun? A little cough button on this would be a little bit superfluous, I think. Anyways, for who resists his will? There is a question. For who resists God's will? God's will is all-encompassing. God's will is final. But there is a, I don't know, there's a sense in which this statement is saying it can't be this way. There is an undercutting of God's freedom that is part and parcel of this objection. And that comes out, I think, in the response in verse 20. On the contrary, who are you, a man who answers back to God? Now, I've read a lot of commentaries on Romans chapter 9, and there have been some great commentators from ages past who have, in essence, given this interpretation of Romans chapter 9, verse 20, and that is, well, Paul does not answer this question. Paul does not actually give us a response to this question. He leaves it in the realm of faith and mystery. His response is meant to indicate to us that we're just to leave this in the hands of God, and that it is not really a subject that can be given an answer that will satisfy the probings of man, so on and so forth. With all due respect to those who say that, I don't think that they're following Paul's argument, and I don't think they're following the application that comes thereafter. I think that there is a full response given in verse 20. The illustrations following thereafter, I think, bear that out. But it is interesting to note the order in which Paul writes his words in verse 20 doesn't really come out well in English translation. Literally, it starts off, oh man, on the contrary, who are you, the one answering back to God? And it uses a participial form there to, again, in a very descriptive way, show us who Paul is addressing here. But starts off, oh man, addressing the individual who has made this type of objection. And that's the first place it has emphasis. Oh man, who are you, the one answering back to God? Now, there's a number of words for responding to, giving an answer to in Koine Greek, but this one has within it, because of it's a strengthened form, the idea of answering back with the implied concept of a rebuttal or a refutation. And so Paul understands the objection of verse 19 to carry within it the very attitude of creaturely arrogance and rebellion that marks all of what mankind really does outside of Christ. And he emphasizes this with the use of that, oh man. The answer is seen in recognizing the two categories of beings that are mentioned in verse 20. Man, ontologically, is a creature. And the point that he's going to bring out in the illustration of the thing that is formed will not say to the one who formed it, is that he's emphasizing that man is the created creature of God. That everything that man is, he owes to God giving it to him. He owes his life, his breath, every heartbeat, everything that he has to God. And so he contrasts the creature. Oh, man, who are you to respond back to argue against, to reply to God? And so you have the creature man ontologically finite and created over against God, who is ontologically eternal, who is in his nature uncreated, who is the ground and foundation of everything else that exists. And so you have, first of all, a rebuke. First of all, a reminder of who man is, and then a rebuke for man failing to remember what he actually is. So the first thing we see is these very strong uses of terms and the strong address to man as man, and in essence rebuking man, will the thing that is formed say to the one who formed it, why do you make me like this? There is an absurdity, an impropriety, a natural impropriety in that which is created, questioning the design, power, even the goodness of the one who made it. There is an absolute right of the creator to do with what he creates as he wishes. And that will be then brought out very clearly in verse 21, or does not the potter have a right over the clay to make from the same lump one vessel for honorable use and another for common use? In other words, if man recognizes what he truly is and recognizes God for who he truly is, then the entire basis of the objection in verse 19 is washed away, that the pot does not have the right to stand up and to in essence, forget about that mark. He's a cup, and on the bottom of those cups that we have in our plates that we have in our at home, you can turn it over, and it says, you know, it gives you the name brand of who made it, and tells you whether it's microwave safe and whether you can put in the dishwasher and all the rest of that neat, wonderful, fun stuff. And basically, it is the cup, ignoring the fact that it says made by the maker, made by the potter on his underside. Forgets that that's there, acts like it's not there. In fact, acts as if he can make the potter, he can make his maker sit in the defense chair, in essence, and bring accusation against him. And he has no right to do that. I really think most of us would be somewhat dumbfounded if we came home and found all of our pots and our pans and our dishes and our plates gathered around arguing whether we have utilized them the way that best fits their perceptions of how we should do so. I can just see the plain brown plates that we have that we use all the time gathering together in rebellion against the china plates over in the closet that sit there, and they sit up nice and pretty, and they have little lights you can turn on in our nice pretty wood cabinet with the glass doors. And I can just imagine that the brown plates that get used every day and that get, you know, the pasta stuck on them, and you sometimes you have to run them through the dishwasher twice because they don't get completely clean. And, you know, they have to work every day. And those china plates, Thanksgiving and Christmas, is the only time they ever have to wander out of their nice, pretty little home. And I would imagine that if we let them get together, those brown plates would sign a declaration of grievances against their owners, who aren't actually their owners, but their benevolent, what would plates call us anyways? I'm not really sure exactly what terminology they would use, but they'd have to admit on some level that we are ontologically superior to them since they don't have any fingers and hands and they can't move without helping them. But then again, we can't either without God helping us, huh? But we don't really think that way, so they probably wouldn't give it a second thought to call us on the carpet and accuse us of being unjust and unloving and unkind because we had chosen to buy plain brown dishes to use for everyday stuff. In fact, to be perfectly honest, there have been times when one of our plain brown dishes has found itself under the snout of our dog, Lexi, as she finished up something that we could not finish up. Now, that probably would be considered a horrible, reprobating thing to do. But sometimes we just figure the poor dog, you know, and she's just begging, those big brown eyes and the ears are up and she looks really nice and okay, here I have the rest of my scraps. And that's a terrible thing to do though, isn't it? Well, no, it's not. That's why we have the dishes. But you see, that's the real rub, isn't it? How dare you compare us to a lump of clay? How dare you compare us to a pot, to a dish, to a cup? We are man. And that really is where the problem is. There is a simple unwillingness to accept this. I can guarantee you one thing. Mormon folks do not like this kind of illustration. Do not like this kind of illustration. Because from their perspective, there is no ontological distinction between God and man. We're all the same species. Well, all the same species. We're just at different points in the continuum of exaltation. So you can imagine the Mormon looks at Romans chapter 9 and just goes, what in the world was he babbling about? Aren't we glad we have modern-day prophets to help us understand that this is actually totally irrelevant? Because functionally, that's what ends up happening. From the Mormon perspective, this is irrelevant. I do not know of a single published commentary on this passage by a Mormon scholar. The only commentary I know on Romans is Romans chapter 1. And I've looked at it, and it made absolutely no sense. But there's no basis in their theology for that. Sadly, for many evangelicals, there's no basis in their theology for it either. But I don't want to rush through it, so we will pick up here. I'm not sure if, Mr. Callahan, I'm not sure. I need to talk with Dr. Renahan as to whether I'm supposed to be in San Diego preaching someplace next Sunday. I know I'm teaching at Westminster on Monday and Tuesday. That thing on the board about the Institute of Reformed Baptist Theological Studies. Hopefully I'll find out tomorrow whether I'm supposed to be over there or not. I don't know. We'll let you know. What? Yeah, well, you know what I mean. Well, be nice to me. I'm half blind. Old, fat, bald, and half blind. I'm starting to wonder why I'm going to get my double ARP card. That's all I can say. I want to be able to go and get my discounts over at Luby's or something like that. All righty, so we'll pick up, we'll sort of get a take running start 19 through the rest of it next week. You got that down? Got a little arrow there? Okay. All right, let's close the word of prayer. Father, we do thank you for your word and the reminder that it gives us of who we are and the fact that you have been merciful to us, and the fact that you have condescended to enter into your creation to redeem us is only all the more amazing when we truly consider that you are the potter and we the clay. We thank you for loving us. We ask you to be with us now in worship. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.